This morning, I want to look at integrity in the life of a believer. It's kind of the main thing we're going to be looking at, how to live a life of integrity. We'll look at an example of that this afternoon after the potluck. I intend on doing a testimony of sorts, so just so you know what's coming this morning and then this afternoon. But first, I want to, like I said, talk about living a life of integrity. And, you know, my mind's been kind of mulling this over a little bit in light of, you know, all the stuff that's happening in the news right now or over the last little bit. There's a whole lot of scandal happening in a whole lot of places. And it has to do because the people that are getting caught up in those scandals are not living a life of integrity. We see it in our political realm. You think of what happened with Patrick Brown and you know, what happened years ago in his life, what he was accused of, even kind of on the other end of the political realm, the liberals that are in power, the scandals that they have about things like gas plants and payoffs. You can see it at the federal level as well, people acting out of turn. But it's not just in the political realm that we see that. We see it as well kind of in Hollywood. You think of all the scandal that's going on there, people being accused of doing a lot of things. Think of the sports. I'm a sports guy. Think of the sports world. And not only is there, you know, the conduct on the field, but conduct off the field. And so I'm a big baseball guy, and one of the things that's going on right now is people are moving forward in debating whether people should be in the Hall of Fame is, yeah, were they a steroid user? And while there's not necessarily a whole lot of proof in that, people are being kept out of the Hall of Fame who have had tremendous careers because they don't have integrity in their character and what they've done and how they portray themselves. And so living a life of integrity is really important in the world, but also in the Christian world. And I'd say the Christian world is not immune to scandal of people's character. You can think of lots of people, especially in, you know, kind of the televangelist circles of a few decades ago, especially, that there were many people in that were seen by the world as being Christian, whether they were or not. But the Christian world got a kind of a bit of a smear when all these people that were held up as being good, strong Christian folk were brought down pretty quickly because they did not live a life of integrity. So I want to focus a little bit on that this morning. As far as thinking of what it is, a bit of a dictionary definition of integrity is the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles, or living a life of moral uprightness. And we talk about this at work. We talk about, you know, having integrity in what you do. And the way that we kind of define it as, you know, in a more understandable way is doing what you should even if somebody isn't watching you. And I would say that's a pretty good benchmark for what it means to live a life of integrity. Doing what you're supposed to do even if somebody's not watching you. What we're going to look at today, we're going to look at the life of Daniel, and we're going to see that that definition could be tweaked a little bit to doing what you're supposed to even if people are watching you. And you may know what we're going to be looking at, but if you want to turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 6, we're going to look at the life of Daniel, see that he lived a life of integrity, and he did it in a hostile situation, not when people were turned aside, but when people were actually focused on him. So in Daniel chapter 6, we're going to look at how he lived that life of integrity, take a few lessons from that, and see how we can apply them in our lives today. So read the first 9 verses for starters. This is kind of the setup that his detractors are going through to bring Daniel down. So Daniel 6, starting in verse 1, reading to verse 9. It pleased Darius to set up over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these 3 governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the other governors and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought of setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the laws of his God." So the governors and the satraps thronged before the king and said to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom and the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or any man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree." And we'll pause there. So in this section, the setup, we see just by kind of background that Darius has come in and he's set up a new government. If you look back in Daniel 5, that's where there was the writing on the wall and the kingdom that was in charge there, Belshazzar, he was overtaken by the Medes and Persians. And so we see that kingdom's gone away, a new kingdom has kind of come to town, as it were, taken over, and Darius is the one now in charge. And that he's going to set up his government to work the way he wants. And so the way that he's devised it is that there's going to be, you know, kind of him at the top. There's going to be three governors. There's going to be 120 satraps under him. And so he's got these layers of administration. And it says that they're doing it this so that he doesn't suffer any loss. Essentially, he wanted to make sure he was getting all the money that he was supposed to. And he didn't want any of that to go away, go astray. And so he sets up this administration to make sure that all the things that are supposed to happen. We see that Daniel is counted amongst one of the most important people in this new kingdom. It says that he's one of the three governors. So he's in a pretty exclusive club and an exclusive spot within the kingdom. And again, he must have shown some promise in that regard. Darius must have seen something in him or heard about him from others to have Daniel be in charge of so many people. And as we continue on reading, in verse 3, we read that Daniel distinguished himself above all the others. And he did it because there was an excellent spirit in him. And so not only was Daniel kind of one of the three people, you know, those of us that are still in the working world, sometimes you think some people get jobs because they know somebody or they've been here forever or, you know, that kind of stuff. You're like, how is that guy still here? What is that guy still doing here? You know, how did they ever get promoted? But Daniel's definitely not one of those people. He has proven himself to be a good worker. And, you know, that says a lot about him. But, again, if you think about Daniel's background, for him to distinguish himself in a hostile territory is, you know, even better. He's not in his homeland. He's not in his home world. Remember, he was taken out of his comfy situation with all the other people that were around him. He was taken out at a young age. He was indoctrinated, or they tried to indoctrinate him into the teachings of the Babylonians. And instead of kind of falling prey to what they thought or what they wanted, he continued to believe in his God. He has continued to serve his God. And you get the sense that he is not serving in the kingdom kind of grudgingly or, you know, kind of doing the bare minimum. I know some people at work who it's like, oh, we can't fire them because, you know, they're technically doing all the stuff that they're supposed to. But they do it in a sour way, or, you know, they're doing like the bare minimum to get by. I also had friends in school that did that, where, you know, a lot of us were trying to get the highest marks, and I had friends that were like, 51, I'm good. Even when I was getting my accounting designation, you needed a 60 to pass, and everything rode on the final exam. It was 100% of your mark came on the final. And my boss would be like, oh, did you pass? And like, yeah, what mark did you get? And I'd tell her, she's like, oh, that's way more than 60. Why did you study so hard? You know, we don't get that sense. And she was kidding. She didn't actually mean it. She wasn't telling me I did a poor job. But with Daniel, we see that that it's noted that he distinguished himself above others. So he was a hard worker. And the motivation behind that is that there was an excellent spirit in him. And because of that, the king looks to maybe making Daniel, you know, the second most important person or most powerful person in the kingdom. So Daniel definitely had this life of integrity that was showing to others, even his boss. And then as we continue on in verse 4, we see that because of Daniel's character, what he was doing, his peers are jealous of him. So he's just trying to do a good job, he's doing what he's supposed to, and his peers don't like it. And so they look for ways to knock him down a peg. They're trying to find ways to get him in trouble, and they're doing it for their own selfish gain. It's a zero-sum game, but you know, if Daniel's out of the picture, then one of them becomes the next most powerful person. And maybe one of the satraps, one of the 120, can move up to be one of the three. And so there's this power struggle that exists in the kingdom. And I don't think Daniel's oblivious to it, but he isn't making choices based on what other people are going to do. And we'll see that he just continues on, regardless of what others are doing, what others say, and what it might mean to him. He's living that life of integrity. We also see with the people that are trying to accuse him is that they run into a really, really big problem for them. They're like, let's find a way to take this guy down a peg. They are digging in his background. They're those investigative journalists who are trying to find that one little thing that he did wrong way back when that they can bring up, you know, decades later and cause a scandal. And it says they can't find anything. In verse 4, it says that they sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. And so we see that Daniel is showing his integrity in at least two different ways. We see that he was faithful. That speaks to his professional integrity. So the king, remember, he set this up so that he wouldn't suffer any loss, so he wouldn't have any lose any of the money. And we see that Daniel was faithful in doing that. So he was doing his job to the best of his abilities, distinguishing about himself above others, and he wasn't skimming off the top, or he wasn't taking a little bit and keeping it for himself. You think of, fast forward into the New Testament, and the tax collectors were hated because that's exactly what they did. They charged people extra, and then they'd keep some for themselves. We don't see that in Daniel at all. And second, we see that they could find no error or fault in him, and that talks to his personal integrity. So not only was he doing his job well, but they couldn't find any fault or scandal in his personal life, in his, you know, outside of the office hours, which has been the downfall of so many and, you know, is one of the things, again, that kind of twigged in my mind, this whole idea of living a life of integrity. We see that very much in the life of Daniel. Then in verse 5, we see, I can't attack him in his professional life. We can't attack him in his personal life, so let's go after something else. And in verse 5, they say, we'll not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. And so Daniel should take that as a really big compliment. They can't find any problem with him in what he does at work. They can't find any problem in what he does kind of on his own. And they say, you know what, where we might be able to get him? He's really, really faithful to his God. Maybe there's something there that we can dwell on. Maybe there's something there that we can cause a problem for Daniel. And then they figure out a way to do that. And they come forward and they do exactly that. In the next few verses, in verses 6 to 9, his enemies devise this plan. And the plan is essentially to have a law put in place that everybody in the kingdom can only pray to the king. You can only pray to Darius. And so their strategy is devised on falsehood and on flattery. And so the falsehood side comes in because they say that they go to the king and they say in verse 7, all the governors of the kingdom and administrators and satraps and counselors, advisors, have consulted together to and we want you to establish this decree. Well, it wasn't all of them. They're making it sound like there were 123 people sitting in the room coming up with, you know what would be a really good idea? Let's do this. And there's at least one person missing, if not more. And they're devising this law. So think about that. It's like, let's come up with this law to get this one person in trouble. He's too good. Is there any way that we can knock him down a peg? I know it's not exactly the same, but this makes me go back to when I was a kid and a really big hockey fan. Wayne Gretzky was like too good of a hockey player, so they changed rules so that he couldn't score as many points. And because he was scoring like 250 points a season, they're like, yeah, you know what, maybe we should do come up with some new rules so he doesn't score as many points because he's making everybody else look bad. And so they actually enacted some rules that are still in place today just because he was too good. And in a similar way here, we see that Daniel's opponents are there coming up with ideas to get only Daniel in trouble. Praying to the king was not a big deal for the rest of them, but it was a big deal for Daniel because they knew that he was faithful to his God. So they come up with this idea, and they say falsely that all of them had this idea, and then they use flattery and say, you know what the idea is? You're really important. Everybody should just pray to you because you're so important. And so the king's like, I am kind of important. Maybe that is a good idea. And so he signs into law that everybody has to pray to him for the next 30 days, and if anybody does something different, they're going to be thrown into the lion's den. And they use this flattery to bring this law into force. And Darius was fooled because he wanted the attention. He wanted all of that. He wasn't really living a life of integrity. If he knew anything, he should say, why would you pray to me? I can't do anything for you. You know, I can't help you in any way. But he was flattered by the whole thing and said, yeah, let's do that. Because he wanted to be more important in the eyes of everyone. And so that's the trap. So that's the setup of the trap that is laid for Daniel. The next few verses, 10 to 17, deal with the takedown. And so we'll read those now. Starting in verse 10, it says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day, and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God, and they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast in the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. And the king, when he heard those words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. And these men approached the king and said to him, know, O king, that it is law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, will deliver you. Then the stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, with all the signets of his lords, and that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. And we'll stop there. So we have the takedown now. Back in verse 10, we read that Daniel finds out that this law has come into force, and he has an interesting reaction to it. His reaction is, I'm going to keep doing what I've always done. Not, oh man, this law is bogus. I'm going to go fight it. It's not, okay, now I have to do things quiet and secret, or, yeah, I'll follow it for 30 days, and then I'll go back to doing what I normally do. Daniel was living a life of integrity in a hostile place, and just kept doing what he normally did. We see that he went home. In his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks to before his God, as was his custom since early days. In such a situation, to go and give thanks to the Lord would have been probably not my first reaction. I would have been probably begging for anything else to happen. And I don't know that I would have had my windows open. But he was following his custom since early days. And he just kept doing it. We see as well, continuing on in verses 11 to 13, that it just so happens that some of his enemies that came up with this law were close to Daniel's house when he was doing this. What a odd coincidence, right? You know, that they would just happen to be out there and maybe listening to what was going on or maybe looking to see what was happening. It's a really odd coincidence that those kind of things happen. But you can see them, you know, they cooked up a brand new law to make this happen, and then they were sure that they were going to nail Daniel for this. And they were sure it was going to happen because they knew that he had this life of integrity, that he was going to continue on regardless. And so they wait, and then as soon as they see him doing it, boom, run to the king. And then their approach to the king is kind of interesting as well. They just question, like, didn't you just sign this law into order? Like, yeah, I did. Oh, well, we already found somebody breaking it. And they go and rat out Daniel. And again, the way they do it in verse 13 is kind of interesting. Remember, this is Daniel, one of the governors in the kingdom, who may be promoted to second in command. Listen to the way that they talk about him. That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah. So already, they're not identifying him kind of by his rank in the kingdom or any of that kind of stuff. They're saying, hey, that Jew, he's still praying to his Jew God. They're calling him out as not one that has importance in the kingdom, but as one that is not following the rule. And so they say, he's not following the rule. He doesn't show due regard for you, that thing that you've just signed. And we see the king's instant response in verse 14. When he heard these words, he was greatly displeased with himself. He has that moment where his stomach drops and he's like, ooh, that's why this happened. And I fell for it. And then we see that he goes on and he looks for any loophole to get out of it for the rest of, in the rest of this section. He goes on and he's trying to find any way to get out of it. He said, maybe there's something. He knows that the law can't change, but maybe he missed something. And he works and he works and he works to try to find it. And then toward the end of the day, Daniel's accusers come back and they say, King, you know, this has to happen. The law says this has to happen. And the king couldn't find any way out of it. He says, make it so. And so they take Daniel, they put him in that den, and they seal it up with the king's ring and with the ring of the others. So that's the takedown. The final section we'll read is the twist, and then we'll look at some of the points of the life of Daniel's integrity. So starting in verse 18, we'll read to the end of 23, and this is the twist. Now the king went to the palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning, went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you continually, who you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths so that they may not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him, and also, O king, I've done no wrong before you. Now the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel out of the lion's den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. So the king had looked for a way to free Daniel when that couldn't happen. They throw him in the den. Part I neglected to mention is that the king actually has faith in Daniel's God. In verse 16, he says, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." And so it seems like the king has faith in Daniel's God. I would say it's a fleeting faith based on what actually happens in the following verses. And what we started to read in verse 18, we see that the king is just distraught about what's going on. And so he says, "Your king or your God's going to save you." But then the king goes back to his palace, says he spent his whole night fasting. There were no musicians brought to him. He was in a sour mood. It says he couldn't sleep. And so for somebody that's making kind of such a bold statement of "your God will deliver you," he's not really acting that way at all. He's really apprehensive about it. And he continues on that way until early morning. And then he rushes off. He wants to know what's happened to Daniel, a person that he cares about and does such a great job. I think the king probably cared for Daniel somewhat on a personal level. I think he probably cared about him more on a kind of a professional level, because, you know, he was getting all the money that he was supposed to out of Daniel's territories, and I think he probably wanted that to continue. So he rushes off, goes to find Daniel, and calls out to him and says, "You know, did your God save you?" And then he hears that voice. Here's Daniel saying, "Yes, my God saved me. He sent an angel down, shut the lion's mouth, and I'm saved." And so everybody's happy. In verse 23, the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that they should take him out. So Daniel is saved, and he's brought out. And then as we read in verse 24, we read that the lions did not forgo a meal that day. They just had to wait a little bit longer. It says, "And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel and cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den." And so they didn't get to feast on Daniel that night, but they got a full meal in the morning. So the lions were not want for a meal. I read a funny phrase about it. It was that something, I don't even recall who wrote it, but it was something along the lines is that the lions probably wouldn't have liked eating Daniel anyway, because he was all grizzle and backbone anyway. And so they just had to wait for a few hours to get the meal that they really deserved. So we see that Daniel survived this situation, but he didn't waver in his integrity. And so in the time we have left, I just want to look over the kind of three areas that Daniel showed integrity. And we've talked about them somewhat already. He showed it in his personal life. He showed it in his professional life. And he showed it in his prayer life. And so we see that constant character of Daniel coming through in each of those: his personal life, professional life, and prayer life. So we'll start with his personal life. As we talked about back in verse 4, his peers couldn't find any fault in him, even when they were looking really, really, really hard. And, you know, they were just trying to find anything that could blow up his career. They really didn't care about what he did in his personal life, but they were looking, is there some way I can leverage this to cause problems? Working in the municipal government, we have those kind of conversations. When things happen, it's typically more at a provincial or a federal level, because that's more party politics as opposed to individual politics. But whenever that kind of stuff comes out, we have those conversations about, you know, how important it is for these public figures to have integrity in their personal life. So many careers have been ripped apart because of not doing a bad job, but being a bad person or doing things that are against the law. And we don't see that in Daniel's life at all. And this isn't new to Daniel. At this point, Daniel's about 80 years old. He's been in the away from Israel. He's been taken captive for decades. But we see right at the start of his life as it's recorded in the book of Daniel, that even from that young age, that Daniel had integrity in his personal life. We see in Daniel 1 verse 8, it's when they're trying to get him to eat food that he doesn't think he's supposed to. and trying to give him things. See that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. And so Daniel had that personal integrity from when he was probably a teenager, when he was taken out of his homeland, and when they were trying to indoctrinate him with, you know, the food, the culture, the teaching, the customs of the Babylonians. And he said, no thanks, that's not for me. He was rooted in what he knew was right, and he wasn't going to waver from it. And here we see decades later that he didn't waver from it. He just lived that life of integrity in his personal life the whole way through. And while it wasn't always easy for him, he continued with it. And so, like Daniel, we need to set our minds to do what is right, even when it's not easy, even when it's hard. And, you know, having kids already, I have those kind of conversations, more so with Jonah, because he's 10, and, you know, getting into things, and he sees some of the stuff his friends are doing, or things that they're saying, or, you know, talking about things that he knows aren't right, and, you know, it's like, you just need to, like, don't get dragged into that. You need to live a life that you know is right. And it's kind of funny, swearing is one of the things that, you know, some of his friends were into last year. And, he would come home and tell us, he's like, yeah, we made an awesome, like, snow fort at school today. And he's like, but then I didn't play with it. It's like, what? Why not? Like, you spent all this time making this snow fort, why wouldn't you play with it? It's like, well, because, like, to get in, you had to swear, and I know that's not right. And so, even as like an 8 or 9 year old, he knew that was wrong because we've had those conversations with him, and he chose to, you know, stop playing with his friends and go do something else. Now, he chooses to do a whole bunch of other dumb things that get him in trouble. So don't think that instead of him is, you know, like he's this great kid that's always perfect all the time, because, well, you're here, you know that's not true. But, you know, it can start young. And our hope as parents is that that continues through his life. So we see that in Daniel, that he had a personal integrity when he was young, and then we see that carrying through his life till decades later. In his professional life, we see that he showed integrity as well. In verse 3, we see that he distinguished himself above the others. And that was in a work sense. That was not that he was better, or, you know, he was a nicer person or whatever. He distinguished himself on a professional level above the others that were in a similar position. And he was so good at it, as we've already talked about, that he was going to be promoted to second in the land, potentially. He would be essentially the prime minister underneath the king. And so Daniel distinguished himself that way. In verse 4, again, we saw that his peers were looking for some way in his, or some flaw in his professional life that they could bring up and take Daniel down. And they couldn't because he was faithful. So he did the job he was supposed to do. And it appears that he actually did it in a, you know, a positive way, not a begrudging way. Like we've already talked about, Daniel is in hostile territory, and he continued to demonstrate this positive character, even though he was in a land where he wasn't surrounded by his friends or people that wanted, you know, him to achieve good things, or, you know, were trying to help him out. He did that in a land where everybody around him believed something different than him. When you read, the people that he was kind of on par with were trying to take him down, and the people that were under him were also trying to take him down, because it might mean that they can move up. But Daniel just continually did what he was supposed to, and there was no flaw that they could turn to. And again, we see that Daniel started this at a young age. If you want to turn back to Daniel chapter 1 with me, we see from a young age that Daniel distinguished himself kind of on a professional level above others. So starting in verse 18 of chapter 1, Well, actually, let's go up to 17. So as for these four men, so Daniel and his friends, after they've eaten the vegetables instead of the king's food, says God gave them knowledge and skills and all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding and visions and dreams. At the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And when the king interviewed them, and among all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them to be 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. And so we see shortly after he's been taken out of his land, that he proved himself to have that professional integrity, to do a good job. He was found 10 times better than everybody else. If you flip with me into chapter 2, and in verse 46, this is where Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about the image in the wilderness, and he's supposed to interpret it. And all the others can't, because the king doesn't tell them what the dream is. They can't tell what the dream is and interpret it, but Daniel can. And Daniel gives credit to God earlier in here and says, no man can do this, but the God of heaven, who made everything, he can reveal dreams and their meanings, and so he does. And then in verse 46, it says, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is the God of gods and Lord of lords and revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king that he and set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. And so a different king, a different time in his life, again, he would have been like a teenager or maybe 20 or what have you at that point, Daniel showed professional integrity and was promoted because he did a good job. So as Christians, we should have a similar work ethic. And we're called to do that. If you flip to Colossians 3 with me, as Christians, we're called to do that, not because we're, you know, working for man, but because we're working for God. In Colossians 3, in verse 22, we read, bondservants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord, and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. So in our work lives, you know, we should have integrity in what we do. We should be seen as people that do an honest day's work, do a good job. And we see that Daniel did that and was promoted for it. Final area we'll look at is in his prayer life. And again, back in Daniel 6 and in verse 10, we get some insight into Daniel's prayer life about what was his custom. It says, now Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. So just 3 points to bring out about Daniel showing integrity in his prayer life. One is that he had an established prayer time. It says that he prayed 3 times that day, as was his custom since early days. And so Daniel had a time set aside in his daily routine to do that. And again, if you think of who Daniel was and what he was doing, so an 80-year-old that's working as one of the top people in the country, if anybody could have said, you know what, I'm kind of a busy guy, it would have been Daniel. It would have been really easy for him to say, you know what, I have to, you know, I have to get everything ready. I've got this person coming in I need to see. I've got to do that, whatever. It would have been very easy for Daniel to set aside his prayer life because he was a busy guy, but we see that he didn't do that. He'd established his habit of praying, and he was keeping with it. And habits are things that can be difficult to get into, but once you have them, they're hard to break. And so that's true of things that are good or things that are bad. You can have good habits and you can have bad habits. I've never been into smoking, but I know plenty of people that have tried to quit, and it's really difficult for them because it's their habit. I remember somebody at work saying, that they were really proud of somebody in the office. It's like, oh yeah, I'm so proud of her. She's quit smoking like 6 times. Like, I don't think she has. So once you have a habit, it's something that's difficult to break. And so we see Daniel had that habit of prayer. He had that integrity in his life, around his prayer life. And you're never going to create a habit if you don't try. And so I would say having a regular prayer time is not something that you currently have, it's a good first step. So set in your mind that you're going to do that. Like Daniel, it said he purposed in his heart that he was not going to defile himself. So it takes, mental fortitude, it takes effort, but to create that habit is worthwhile. So he had an established prayer time. Second, he had an established method of praying. And so for him, he knelt down facing Jerusalem. And so the facing Jerusalem piece goes back to something from when Solomon dedicated the temple, and he was talking about, people praying towards Jerusalem if they were taken apart. That's not really something that applies to us today, but Daniel did that. It applied to him in his time. But he had an established method of praying. And so that can mean a whole bunch of things. It could be your posture, whether you're sitting, whether you're lying down, whether you're on your knees. I would suggest there's no one posture you have to take. I would say there's no one time you have to do it. But certain things work better for some. I would say you want something that's somewhat comfortable, but probably not too comfortable, because then, that leads to sleeping. But having an established method is good. Some people use prayer lists or prayer journals or a calendar, something we have. Aaron's made up. Kathy Oriole had made one a while ago, and then we've updated it as people have come in and out of the assembly, added them to a prayer calendar. So that's something we do with our kids that each morning is, we pray for a fifth of the assembly every day after we do morning devotions. And so having, that method works for us. Something different may work for you. As well as, how you pray through things. There's different types of prayer. There's praise and thanksgiving and supplication. There are lots of different ways you can pray. You need to find one that works for you and stick with it. So having an established time, having an established method are ways to lead to success. And the third one we see about Daniel is that he wasn't ashamed of praying. It says that he went, opened up his windows, faced Jerusalem, and prayed like he always did. He wasn't ashamed to do it. And he kept up with it, kind of regardless of the situation. And so we are told in other places that we're not supposed to flaunt our prayer life. In Matthew chapter 6, it talks about how we shouldn't pray like the Pharisees did, where they'd kind of go out in public and they would pray out loud and draw attention to themselves. That's not what we're supposed to be doing at all. But at the same time, we shouldn't be hiding the fact that we're praying. And so that could be true